From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. A suspended opposition MP in Fiji says his court acquittal last week is a major win for him politically. Ratu Asoatikataka was found not guilty last week after failing to declare his liabilities before the 2014 election. The Sotopa MP had earlier been suspended on a different matter for the rest of the parliamentary term. Rata told Sally Round the allegation he owed the government more than $45,000 was a setup.
Politically, I know that I win because it is an allegation which I know which is not true, and it's a setup done purposely to deter me, but I kept on going. The FICAC had actually drilled me down to a level that I thought I was a murderer because of the treatment given to me. But I stood fast because I'm used to this type of situation. Eventually, the truth prevailed. And one thing that I'm grateful about is the judgment delivered by the magistrate that he stood by her oath without fear or favour.
And what about the costs of the trial? Did she make a judgment on that?
The outstanding amount owed to me by government, which is 4,000 plus, she has mentioned that the government owed me that amount. But the other costs that I incur, I will have to decide after 28 days given for appeal. And then after that, then I will raise my concern in terms of the damages incurred to me and the family, and I will have to listen to the advice of my lawyer.
Now that you've been cleared of this, will you be seeking re-election? I know you've been suspended for the rest of the term on another matter. Will you be seeking re-election next year?
Oh, certainly. I'm so delightful. Certainly. This has cleared my name and I'm ready for the election. And even today I'm going out to the first village to go and explain to them that I had difficulty in trying to visit them because we need to clear this doubt first before I can then visit them.
What about the judicial review that you are seeking of the Parliament's decision to suspend you for the rest of the term? Is that still in the works?
Very much so. Then again, it's a case of the truth. That is being handled by the High Court. And I cannot release any of my views because it's being dealt by High Court. I'll remain silent on that.
You just said you were going out to villages today to explain what's happened. Is this going to be a big hurdle for you to campaign now that you've had these court issues against you? How big a hurdle is it going to be?
I think it's the other way around. Remember, the opposition have got difficulties to actually access the media. But in my case, they are actually purposely, almost any chance that they could, they put my case in the television and on the papers almost on a weekly basis, purposely doing for character defamations and all that. But I think the nation has looked at it otherwise. It's probably a plus for me in doing so. And then eventually winning the case makes it a lot better. It is actually promoting me rather than the negative. So the people are happy to visit me, to see me. We're all geared up well for victory in the next election.
Papua New Guinea's Electoral Commission says it's all prepared and ready to go for polling in the general election. But this week, the last stage of campaigning before the two-week polling period starts, there has been a flurry of claims that attempts are being made to rig the election. Johnny Blades is in Port Moresby, and he told Ben Robinson Drawbridge, despite the claims, the commission remains positive.
The Electoral Commission says that all sensitive election materials are now in the various provinces around the country and being sorted out for distribution to each electorate in preparation for polling. Now, these materials include ballot papers, candidate posters, polling schedules, the indelible inks which voters have marked on them after voting, and the electoral rolls. So these materials, the Commission says, have all been dispatched to the regions in a timely fashion with assistance from the Australian Defence Force, I might add, and the PNG Defence Force. and they're saying that everything's good to go and set for the 2017 election.
What's the feel like on the ground there, Johnny? How harmonious is this election likely to be?
It feels a little bit tense, I'd have to say. You know, there's been a lot of words, accusations being slung around between opponents, just a stream of invective on social media that just doesn't stop. A couple of sitting MPs have commented to me how this is the nastiest they've experienced a PNG campaign before. That could be a mark of the dissatisfaction among the public with the parliamentarians themselves, but also maybe a reflection of just how much social media is kind of playing more of a part, you know, with that burgeoning telecommunications scene. So this is really, the public discourse has really gone to a new level. But certainly here in the national capital, there are suggestions of possible rigging, violence or intimidation at play. And, you know, just this morning, Police Commissioner Gary Barkey confirmed there's an investigation into four candidates in the national capital following the leak of chat logs on social media. Now, these four candidates, according to a series of screen grabs during the rounds, have allegedly been caught in conversation plotting to use fake ballot papers to intimidate voters and even plans for violence against the incumbent National Capital Governor, Powers Parkop. But to look at the screenshots that are being circulated, which allegedly incriminate this group, it almost looks too obvious, as if there were a setup at play. So we'll just have to wait and find out what comes of this investigation. But these four candidates did hold a press conference to say that their Facebook accounts had been hacked and messages sent out without them knowing.
Nevertheless, ballot papers remain an area of concern for many candidates.
Yeah, that's right. And ever since the Electoral Commission announced earlier this year that the ballot papers were being printed in Indonesia, there's been so much suspicion that they will be tampered with, you know, claims that there's a surplus amount printed and that some of these will be used later to fabricate results, all sorts of allegations. But, you know, just this week now, the People's Progress Party leader, Ben Miker, has called on the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, and Electoral Commissioner, Petalius Gamato, to immediately conduct an investigation into reports of ballot papers being tampered with and the election being rigged, because he says he has evidence of some candidates holding onto a bunch of ballot papers, and he warned that if this type of rigging proceeds, the country might, quote, go up in flames. So quite an explosive warning there. But I think there's a lot of pressure on the Commissioner to disprove this, but it is quite traditional or typical for the Electoral Commissioner to come under the most intense pressure over preparation for the election as the polling approaches. But so far he's just said any evidence of tampering with election materials simply must be presented to the police.
A nationwide drug crisis has crippled hospitals and health centers in Papua New Guinea, with some hospitals completely running out of supplies. The country has faced a shortage for months after the government drug buying tender lapsed in December. Some hospitals have resorted to desperate measures to keep themselves afloat, while some others have closed altogether. Jamie Tahana reports.
Mount Hagen Hospital, the country's third largest, is completely bare of supplies. Doctors have been unable to stitch wounds or provide antibiotics, and in some cases, desperate staff have had to use patients' clothes because there's no gauze. The hospital's deputy chief executive, David Vorst, says it has been struggling for months as the Department of Health hasn't provided funding or replenished supplies.
The hospital is actually out of everything. We've got doctors and nurses working in very difficult circumstances, delivering babies, for example, without any gloves to protect them. We've got election-related violence at the moment, and people are getting angry because they're coming to the Action and Emergency Department and not being able to be treated.
The secretary of the PNG National Doctors Association, Sam Yokopua, says the situation in Mount Hagen is not unique, with many hospitals struggling to stay afloat.
About eight hospitals have actually shut down their doors or partly shut down for emergencies only. And at the trend at which we are going, by the end of this month, 90% of the hospitals will shut down.
In Kokopo, on East New Britain, the administrator of St Mary's Hospital, Albert Seri, says his hospital is backed up by church funding, but it's still tough.
we have not been getting everything that we ordered from the medical store. And so what happened was we were going to local pharmacies to buy drugs, basically. And we've been able to keep our heads above water.
The crisis has been building for months, if not years. In PNG, drugs and supplies are procured centrally by the Department of Health. But Mr. Vorst says Mount Hagen only receives about 30% of the supplies it asks for each year.
We've had to, for years, actually supplement what we've provided for centrally by spending money which we're actually not budgeted for.
Dr. Yokopua says this has been exacerbated since the government made healthcare free in 2014. Now, hospitals are no longer able to charge a fee to cover costs, and the government is only paying about 10% of what's needed.
Because of the free healthcare policy, what they normally charge a little bit of to the patients, like for example prescription medicines, one kina for one, or x-ray, two kina, stuff like that. Now, no fees as such. Everybody is in free, so effectively no money generated within the hospitals to buy urgent consumables and medicines.
Then in December, the tender for drug procurement lapsed, leaving the country without a supplier for 6 months. But this week, with hospitals on the brink of collapse and doctors threatening to go on strike, the government finally took charge. The government's chief secretary, Isaac Lupari, says five new tenderers have finally been approved, an announcement that brought a collective sigh of relief. In Mount Hagen, Mr. Vorst says his hospital has managed to cobble together some money to get extra supplies, which should start to arrive from next week.
The stocks will start flowing, and I expect that will happen for probably 4 or 5 days before we're completely restocked. And there now appears to be tenders at a national level sorted out, so that what we're doing hopefully is only a bridging thing, you know, where we're buying stuff until the central supply system starts to work again.
But while shelves may slowly start to be restocked, many doctors and administrators agree the new tenders will only go so far, and much more needs to be done to fix the crisis once and for all. This is Jamie Tahana.
And you are listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Beverly Buffett from Norfolk Island says many people there are struggling in the wake of the Australian absorption of the island's government a year ago. Australia, citing concerns that Norfolk could no longer pay its way, removed the island's autonomy and shut down the Legislative Council. A regional council now runs minor matters while big decisions are made in New South Wales. But the change remains controversial. She told Don Wiseman some people on the island are really hurting.
There are people who used to get a Norfolk Island pension who are, because of the land that has been handed down through the generations and they're looking after for future generations, is now considered an asset, even though it makes no money. And their pensions have been cut and they're relying now on members of their families to help them live. The hospital and the school and a lot of the other government buildings, at a stroke of a pen, were taken by the Australian government. These are things that were really important community facilities that they had equipped and built and looked after for many years. And now they're seeing them ripped apart and being changed because they don't meet the standards of another country.
Go back to pensions there for a moment. I understand that there are a significant number of people on the island who had been getting pensions but now are being told that they don't qualify for a whole variety of reasons.
Yes, one of the reasons is that they haven't got birth certificates that the Australian government will recognise. They say the Norfolk Island birth certificate is not a legal document.
Do they say why that's the case?
No, as far as I know, that's the way they see it. They're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, and it's not going to work. You know, things have been done differently here, and it worked in most of the time. And it wasn't till the global downturn that Norfolk Island government actually ran at a deficit.
just look at land, and you mentioned how this is being taken into account even though in most cases the land's not generating anything. But there are also other aspects to the land in Norfolk Island, aren't there, that this was land gifted to the Pitcairners when they arrived there, and in most cases is still held by their descendants. And there's a love of land that maybe corresponds with the way Maori react to land in this country.
Oh, definitely. They see themselves as the guardians of the land for their future generations. It's not theirs in the sense that most Western societies look at land as an asset or something that they can flog off when they want some money. They will hold on to it, come hell or high water, if they can possibly do that, because they know that it was given to them to look after for future generations.
But if this land is not generating anything at this point in time, yet the Australian government is trying to move towards a land-based rating system, isn't it? How are they going to make those sorts of calculations about what the land is worth? And what do people think of that?
They're getting a valuer from New South Wales to come and value the land, and he'll be looking mainly at the last 2 years' sales of land, which has been highly inflated by the Australian government buying up places and paying a lot more than what used to be paid for land. And that's another concern. They're bringing in the rates slowly. There are already people. These are people with commercial properties and things too. They're paying $15,000 in tax already, and this is the first lot. Next financial year it's going to be doubled, and the year after that it's going to go on valuation. And they're saying that the local council that they set up will not be able to operate without these rates. And bearing in mind that Norfolk Island doesn't have a rubbish collection, it doesn't have footpaths in most places, it doesn't have all of those things, it doesn't have water reticulation or wastewater in most of the areas. So what's the rate being charged for?
There has been a protest going on since well before the official Australian takeover in July of last year, a protest at the old Legislative Chamber building, the Tent Embassy, and that's continuing. People are still maintaining that protest.
Absolutely, yes. They see themselves being there for the duration, as long as it takes to get the United Nations to lift Norfolk Island as a non-self-governing territory. That will give them the right to have a vote about their own future.
A month's outbreak in Marshall Islands may be hitting the country much harder than reported. That's according to the country's Ministry of Health. Since the viral disease was first found in the Marshall Islands in March, there have been more than 1,000 confirmed cases. The ministry says the number of cases has been dropping in recent weeks, but it noted that this may be due to underreporting, and officials warn figures could be as high as 3,000. Our correspondent, Giv Johnson, told Mackenzie Smith the outbreak has come at a particularly bad time for the Marshalls.
This time of the year, June and July, we historically have large numbers of people coming in from the remote islands, from the United States and elsewhere to attend annual church conferences. So there's just many thousands of Marshall Islanders on Majuro, in addition to the usual residents, offering up another pathway for mumps to spread. So the ministry says it's getting around to the church groups, trying to talk with people about how to prevent mumps.
And in terms of the numbers that are actually showing up, I mean, the number of confirmed cases seem to be dropping, but the ministry have basically come out and said this might not even be the case, with the true number potentially being underreported. Do we know why this exactly is?
One reason that the actual number of mumps cases may be significantly higher than the 1,033 that were reported as of last week is the ministry thinks that people may be heeding the health officials' advice, which is if you've got any of these symptoms, just stay home. You know, don't go to work, don't go to school where you could expose other people, and don't even come into the hospital unless you are experiencing like a severe problem, because mumps is just something, I mean, for most people, it'll happen, and in a week or 10 days, it'll be gone. So they feel like a lot of people just are not bothering to show up anymore, even though they believe that there are a lot more cases than have been reported to health officials.
So is this a concern, do you think? I mean, they've got a vaccine program in place, which has, you know, been put across the wider region, but with the underreporting, is that a cause for concern?
Well, of course, you'd like to know the true extent of an outbreak, but if people staying home and not coming in to report helps to limit exposure, there's nothing wrong with that. And my feeling is that it seems like, looking at the data over the last 3 months of this outbreak, like in April and May, the numbers spiked very high, and there was 1 week when they had 140 cases. So the fact that it's dropped to under 40 per week the last couple of weeks suggests that, you know, they are down. I don't know much else that the Ministry of Health can do aside from the vaccines. They've had a lot of vaccines donated. These are MMR, the mumps, measles, rubella shot. Thousands of doses were donated by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and so they've been using those. And they've been pretty active with their immunization campaign. So, I mean, part of the challenge too, according to one of the doctors I talked to, who is managing the outbreak, is they say that just having the MMR, the mumps vaccine, doesn't necessarily prevent you from getting mumps, but it generally prevents it from being like a serious case. And this is why they think they've actually got reasonably good coverage on immunizations, because a very small number of the mumps cases that have been presented, very small number have been ones that have serious, like, secondary effects, and they're pretty happy about that, because that suggests to them that they have immunization coverage, at least for the children.
As the 10th anniversary of Tonga's participation in New Zealand's recognized seasonal employment scheme approaches, its proponents say overall it has been mutually beneficial, and there is still room for improvement. This is despite a recent increase in misbehavior among young Tongan RSE workers in New Zealand. Karori Hawkins has more.
Next month, Tonga will mark the 10th anniversary of its participation in New Zealand's recognised seasonal employment scheme. It is the second largest contributor of Pacific seasonal labour to the horticulture and viticulture sectors in New Zealand, with more than 1,600 workers making the journey from Tonga last year. Vanuatu is the largest, supplying around 4,000, and Samoa a close third with around 1,400 last year. Tonga's RSE liaison officer in New Zealand, Sefita Haoli, said a lot of work has gone into getting Tonga's RSE participation to where it is today.
That's a very, very high number of our unemployed and members of our more needy families, our more deprived families, to be able to come and earn a living.
But it has not all been smooth sailing. Tonga has the highest rates of workers failing to turn up for work and even absconding altogether. In fact, Mr. Haoli said in the first 4 years of the scheme, around 40 Tongans absconded because of a disagreement with their contractor, and today at least 15 Tongans remain unaccounted for. Mr. Haoli says the approach Tonga is taking to try and address the problem is prevention.
And part of that happens by making sure that the people we select to come over are carefully vetted so that we can understand why they're in New Zealand to work, and more importantly, they actually have good reason to go back.
The same approach was touted by Tonga's Prime Minister Akilisi Pohiva as a solution to a recent increase in the number of young Tongan seasonal workers who have been misbehaving. Alcohol-related incidents last year and this year both resulted in some workers being sent home. There have also been allegations in New Zealand media that some of these men had committed serious sex crimes. During a joint press conference in Nuku'alofa last week, Mr. Pohiva apologised to New Zealand's Prime Minister Bill English for any strain the incidents had placed on the relationship between the two countries and assured Mr. English that the issue was being dealt with.
We will continue to make sure that the selection process from this end is done properly so that we can make sure that the people from we select from this end, they are the right people to do the work.
New Zealand Prime Minister Bill English said more than 10,000 Pacific workers participate in seasonal work in New Zealand each year, and the majority of them contribute positively to the scheme. Mr. English said he was confident that those who did misbehave were being dealt with and measures looked at to reduce such instances.
Both in my visit to Samoa and to Tonga, I've been impressed to find the Prime Ministers of each country taking a close personal interest in the behaviour of the RSE workers, and I'm satisfied that they will do whatever they can. Now, that's not a guarantee that every single one of them will behave perfectly, but I'm sure they're going to do what they can to reduce the opportunities.
Savita Haole says the increase in behavioural problems among Tongan workers is directly related to a change in policy favouring younger, fitter workers over older ones. Mr. Haole says while there are obvious teething problems with the policy, he believes it is the right one.
The transition to younger workers, in a way, is actually meeting the objectives of the scheme. The scheme was there to address unemployment and poverty. That's for our end of it. For New Zealand, it offers you a steady stream of workers that you can count on, committed to you to be able to do the work and help lift our horticultural and viticultural sector.
Looking to the future, Tongans are part of a pilot group of Pacific construction workers helping out in the Christchurch rebuild, and there is interest from the region for New Zealand to also consider Pacific workers for semi-skilled labour in other areas such as hospitality and old age care. According to Savita Haole, 10 years on, Tonga's participation in seasonal work has been a mostly positive one. This is Koroi Hawkins.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Just a quick reminder that listeners in the Pacific can listen to a 15-minute edition that's produced three times daily. You'll find the complete schedule at our website, pcjmedia.com. The program is broadcast through our partner stations in the region and also on shortwave and satellite. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Now, this edition of the program that you're listening to is the general worldwide edition that is also broadcast to Europe, North America, and Africa. So we also welcome listener comments from those regions as well. It's the same email address, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Until then, so long and take care. Bye-bye, everyone.